The message you are about to hear is the 11th in Bishop John W. Howe's series on the Gospel of Luke. It is entitled, Signs of the End.
Two things I want us to look at today. They're called the Little Apocalypse in Luke 21, the Little Revelation, a book very much like the book of Revelation, sometimes called the Apocalypse, the Little Apocalypse, and then in Luke 22, the story of betrayal, the Last Supper and Judas calling in the soldiers to arrest Jesus. But just before we get to that, as we continue moving steadily toward Jesus' final conflict, his crucifixion and resurrection, I just want you to notice Luke's little editorial comments at the end of a series of vignettes. The vignettes are very familiar to us, and I'm not going to try to get into them, but I just want you to notice how Luke editorializes as he tells each one of these. Back in chapter 19, toward the end of the chapter, he sends his disciples to get the colt for him to ride into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, and verse 39, it says that as the crowd is hailing him, it's acclaiming him, blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven, glory in the highest heaven, some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to him, tell your disciples to shut up. And his answer is, I tell you, if these were silent, the very stones would cry out. I want you to get the shape of what's happening here. Jesus is being acclaimed more and more loudly and broadly by the crowds, and the religious leadership is trying to clamp down on it harder and harder. Just notice how that unfolds. He's teaching in the temple. It says every day, openly teaching in the temple, and by the way, the Synoptic Gospels locate the cleansing of the temple during this last week. John puts it at the very beginning of his ministry, sort of a statement about Jesus' ministry that, in a broad sense, his whole ministry was a matter of bringing cleansing to the temple and to the religious worship of Israel. But the Synoptics say that it actually happened during Holy Week, following the triumphal ride into Jerusalem. What could be more open, what could be more public than his cleansing the temple and hanging around, teaching there day after day? The leaders, it says in verse 48, want to kill him. It's gotten to that point. They want to kill him. They're looking for a way to kill him, but they didn't find anything they could do, for all the people were spellbound by what they heard. They increasingly try to trap him. They ask him, by what authority are you doing all these things? And we see Jesus just weaving his way through their attempted traps. They're not able to move because of the popularity that he has with the people, so they try little entrapment schemes, and one after another, he cuts through them. Jesus says, unless you tell me where John got his authority, I'm not going to tell you where I got mine. He turns the trap right around against them. He tells a parable against them. It's very clearly against them. You are the subject of this parable. Verse 20 and chapter 20 and verse 19, when the scribes and chief priests realized that he had told this parable against them, they wanted to lay hands on him at that very hour. But they feared the people. And so it continues. Series of trick questions, and Jesus won't be tricked by any of them. Verse 26, they're amazed by his answer and became silent. And chapter 20, verse 40, they no longer dared to ask him any more questions. Just want us to be aware of that. The people are loving what they're hearing. Loving what they're hearing. More and more of them daring to believe that this really could be the long-awaited Messiah. Not just a prophet, not just a mighty teacher, he was all that. Not just a miracle worker, but even more than that. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. That's messianic. People are loving what they're hearing, and the leaders hate it. And as the people love it more and more, they hate it more and more. and they want to kill him, but because they fear the people, they don't act on that desire. Instead, they try to trap him, and Jesus weaves his way through their traps one after another. That's just background. We come to chapter 21, and this is a fascinating passage, an episode recorded by all three of the synoptics, by Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And if we had the time, we could really carefully go through and see the little nuances of difference. I'm going to try to just give you an overview summary of what is said if you put all three accounts together. I really encourage you to go back and read them carefully for yourselves. Matthew records this in chapter 24 and 25. Mark records it in chapter 13. And Luke records it here in chapter 21. Apocalyptic literature is a genre of literature that was well known to the Jews and others, but especially to the Jews. It has to do with the end of the world or the end of this present age as we know it. And that is usually marked by cataclysmic events. And in apocalyptic literature, all that sort of thing is described and told in very vivid imagery, often symbolic imagery. If you're at all familiar with the book of Revelation, you know that I've just described it. It's dealing with the end of the age, catastrophe, calamity, and very, very vivid imagery, which we're told in chapter 1 of Revelation, needs to be interpreted. We're given some of the keys to interpreting Revelation in the very first chapter. The two best-known passages of apocalyptic literature in the Old Testament are Daniel and Ezekiel, and there are passages elsewhere. And we have this, call it a sermon, call it a discourse. It's sometimes called the Olivet Discourse because it was given on the Mount of Olives. Jesus himself speaking apocalyptically. Notice that what follows is actually his response to a double question. Luke 21, verse 5. When some were speaking about the temple, how it was adorned with beautiful stones and gifts dedicated to God, Jesus said, "As for these things that you see, the days will come when not one stone will be left upon another, all will be thrown down." They're commenting on how glorious this temple is. We just had a little group of teenagers come to see the beautiful cathedral. So you get the dynamic. What a beautiful temple it is. It was. And Jesus says, yes, but I tell you, the day is coming when not one stone is going to be left on another. Which provokes a question, and in fact, a twofold question. Verse 7, they asked him, "Teacher, when will this be? And what will be the sign that this is about to take place?" In Matthew's version, it's a little bit clearer. Matthew says, "Tell us, when will this be?" That's the first question. And secondly, "What will be the sign of your coming and of the end or close of this age?" The two issues are apparently linked together in their minds, the destruction of the temple and the return of the Lord. Why? Well, possibly they were connected in Jesus' mind. We'll see a hint of that in a few moments. You remember that when they asked him specifically, "When are you coming back?" He said, what? "Nobody knows. I don't know that. Only the Father knows." Possibly the destruction of the temple and the return of Christ were linked together in his own mind. They certainly were linked together in the disciples' minds. I suggest that it's kind of like two mountains in the distance. If they're far away from you and you're driving along, you look at these two mountains, it appears to you they're side by side. And then when you get up to the first of them, you may discover that the second one is still many miles further away, but from a distance, they look side by side. And in the Old Testament, we have the phenomenon of being the prophets being completely unable to separate the first and the second coming. You know, it's all woven together. Well, how does that fit together? How is the same guy going to suffer and die and rule victoriously forever? Read Isaiah 52 and 53, and it's all bound up together, and it looks like they're right side by side, to the point that some of the rabbis said, well, obviously no one man could do both of those things. There have to be two messiahs. We know in hindsight that what we're talking about is two separate advents, two separate comings. The first one as a suffering servant, a dying Messiah, and the second one, he shall come again in glory to rule, to judge the living and the dead, and his kingdom shall be forever. There is a sense in which, I submit to you, we have been in the end times ever since the ascension onward. It's interesting that when John writes his first letter, he says in 1 John chapter 2, verse 18, children, it is the last hour. Well, it's been a long hour. It's been 2,000 years since he wrote that. But there was a sense on his part that we're in the end times. In any event, you put all three accounts together, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and depending on how you would subdivide it, I see, broadly speaking, 10 signs of the end. Remember, this is Jesus' response to the question, when will this be? And what will be the sign of your coming? And there are 10 things, 10 specifics that Jesus mentions. Not all of them in all accounts. Put them together and you'll find all 10. Some of them have been around seemingly forever. I think the case can be made that as we progress in history, they become more frequent. We see them more often. They are intensifying. The first four signs in particular are like that. He says there will be false prophets and false messiahs. Matthew 24, many will come saying, I am the Messiah, and they will lead many astray. Well, there have always been false prophets. There have always been false Christs. But does it seem to you that we see more and more of those as time goes on? Heaven's Gate, pretty recent example. Jonestown, Guyana, so on. Number two, wars and rumors of wars. Again, there have always been wars. In fact, somebody has calculated that in all of recorded history, there are only 260 years in which there wasn't some war going on. There have been over 100 specific wars since the end of World War II. There have always been wars and rumors of wars. There is an undeniable sense in which that has intensified during especially this last century. Never before have we known world war. And even though we have backed off from it, the world is arguably more dangerous right now than it ever has been, because you have so many different countries with different leadership who have their fingers on triggers all over the place. Wars and rumors of wars. Famines and plagues and shortages. Again, all of history has known famines and shortages. Yet there was a book written called Famine 1975, which made the case that we're seeing famine on an unprecedented scale and it's going to get worse. Number four, earthquakes in various places. So these are some of the signs. You say, well, that's not very specific, Jesus. Those have always been around. How are those signs? Well, okay, they have always been around. Maybe the case can be made that they will intensify as we draw toward the end of the age. Number five, tribulation and persecution. And he goes into a fair amount of detail about that. Even within families, brother will betray brother, sister will betray sister. Children will betray their parents. They'll haul you before the rulers and magistrates. And he says, don't worry about what you're going to say beforehand. The Holy Spirit will enable you. Some people would say, well, he sure got that one wrong. The age of great tribulation and persecution was early on, before Christianity became a state religion, when we had the Caesars throwing people to the lions and burning them at the stake and crucifying them. Wasn't that the age of great persecution and martyrdom? And the answer is yes, it certainly was such a time. But do you know that there are more martyrs for Jesus Christ in the 20th century than in all the previous 1900 years put together? There's no question that that is on the increase. Number six, this one is not in Luke, but it is in both Matthew and Mark. The gospel will be proclaimed to all the nations, and then comes the end. Matthew 24, verse 14, and Mark 13, verse 10. I find that one an interesting one, because that has not occurred until recently, till most of our lives. The gospel has not, in fact, been proclaimed to every people on the face of the earth. And groups like Wycliffe Bible Translators are very vigorously giving themselves to the completion of that task. I believe there's still something like 5,000 languages and dialects that have yet to have any portion of the gospel translated into them. But interestingly enough, the verb used in that statement is keruso, transliterated into English K-E-R-U-S-S-O, and translated in the new RSV, the gospel will be proclaimed, but it also could be translated published, that is, written down for distribution. Obviously, until the printing press, we didn't have publishing as we know it today, but it was, things were written down and distributed. The gospel will be published to every nation. It does not say to every tribe. It says to every nation. And I find that fascinating, because the American Bible Society released a statement in 1956, at long last, this is a quote, at long last, the gospel, in whole or in part, has now been published in the official language of every nation in the world. And we're still a long distance from the total evangelization of all the world. And I already mentioned Wycliffe, and in other ways, groups like Campus Crusade and many, many missionary organizations are working furiously to complete that task. But if you take those words very literally, the gospel will be published to all the nations, or even if you take it in its more generic form, it will be proclaimed to all the nations. That's a done deal as of 1956 and not previously. Number seven, the desolating sacrilege. You might want to just flip over to Matthew 24 and take a look at that one, because it's interesting in a couple of ways. Matthew 24 and verse 15. So when you see the desolating sacrilege standing in the holy place, as was spoken of by the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand, then those in Judea must flee to the mountains. The one on the housetop must not go down to take what is in the house. The one in the field must not turn back to get a coat, and so on. A time of very, very significant tribulation. The sign being the desolating sacrilege. Luke doesn't use that phrase. He does speak of Jerusalem's desolation. But Matthew and Mark seem to be referring to something much more specific, related to, or a repetition of, what Daniel called the abomination of desolation. And the abomination of desolation, as far as scholars are overwhelmingly convinced, occurred in 167 BC when Antiochus Epiphanes erected a statue of Zeus over the altar of burnt offering. Can you imagine that? And commanded people to worship it. It was that triggered the Maccabean revolt. Ernie was speaking about the Maccabees a couple of weeks ago. I mean, talk about a blasphemy to go into the holy place where the Lord alone is to be worshipped, and nobody else but the priests and the high priests could even come into the Holy of Holies. The high priest only once a year on the Day of Atonement. This was off grounds even for faithful Jews. And at the altar of incense just outside, to erect a statue of a false god and command people's worship. This was the abomination of desolation. Now Jesus is saying that's going to happen again, or a continuation of it, or a replication of it. That has already happened. That was fulfilled nearly 200 years ago. See, but he says, when you see the desolating sacrilege or the abomination of desolation, then this is one of the signs. Interestingly enough, very shortly after Jesus was crucified, about 6 or 7 years, Caligula, called the madman, replicated what Antiochus had done. Again, a statue of Zeus, only this time it was Zeus, but it was Caligula. He had become convinced of his own divinity, and he commanded that the statue of himself be worshipped, and that it be worshipped with the offering of pig's blood. Can you feel how that would feel to a Jew? Maybe that's what Jesus was saying, and maybe he was seeing something beyond all of that. I'm fascinated that both Matthew and Mark include this little parenthesis, let the reader understand. What does that tell you? What? Figure it out for you. It tells you more than that. Jesus did not say that, because Jesus wasn't writing this thing down. Jesus was speaking. But as they record it, they include this little editorial comment, let the reader understand, which I think signals you're probably not going to know what that is until it happens. And then if you have done your homework, if you've done your reading, when it happens, you'll know what's at hand here. So I submit to you Caligula's statue was a fulfillment of that, but I suspect we're going to see something even more. What, for instance, would it mean if the Jews were to build yet another temple and go back to offering blood sacrifices? What would that say about the sufficiency of the sacrifice that Jesus offered? What if, it's almost unimaginable, but what if there were some kind of universal religion that were tied together with the Dome of the Rock and a rebuilt Jewish temple, and who knows what's going on? I don't know. But I'm going to bear that little parenthesis in mind. And I suspect we may come to see something and we'll say, aha, that was it. Number 8, the days will be shortened. Sense of time speeding up. The hurrier I go, the behinder I get. Isn't it amazing with all of these incredible tools that we have to make our work easier? Anybody find their work easier? Have much more time off because you've got a computer, right? Do you know what the computer means? Now, instead of having my secretary do all my mail, I get a ton of it at home that I've got to do myself in addition to what I was doing in the office. Number 9, the sun, moon, and stars will be darkened. Luke doesn't specify darkened, but he does speak of signs in the sun, moon, and stars. Matthew and Mark say darkened. That's interesting. Just stop and think what that might mean. Obviously, if something happened to the sun, if there were some, you know, huge explosion that somehow diminished the power of the sun, obviously the moon also would be darkened because it's simply reflecting sunlight. But how in the world do you darken sun, moon, and galaxy upon galaxy of stars simultaneously? I don't know. One way you do that is if you put enough junk up there in the atmosphere. It's interesting. You know, they take oxygen breaks every 30 minutes for the traffic cops in Japan because there's so much pollution in the air. I don't know what that means. Sun, moon, and stars will be darkened. The most interesting is the one that Luke alone has in his account. Luke 21, and I want to start with verse 20. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation has come near. Then those in Judea must flee to the mountains, and those inside the city must leave it, and those out in the country must not enter it. For these are days of vengeance as a fulfillment of all that is written. Woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing infants in those days, for there will be great distress on the earth and wrath against this people. They will fall by the edge of the sword and be taken away as captives among all nations. And Jerusalem will be trampled on, or the older translation says will be trodden down by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Consider the fig tree, says Jesus. The fig tree is always a symbol of Israel, more specifically Jerusalem. Pay attention to what happens to Jerusalem. Jerusalem is going to be trodden down by the Gentiles until, this is an era, this is a historical period, the, quote, times of the Gentiles, unquote, are fulfilled. We started with some signs that were very broad and very nonspecific, and we said, you know, there have been wars and rumors of wars all along. This tenth one is very specific. Jerusalem will be trodden down until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Jerusalem was captured by the Babylonians in 586 B.C. And then we had one empire after another come and conquer, and in the process of conquering the empires that went before, they took over leadership or oversight or captivity of Jerusalem and Judea at the same time. So we had the Greeks, the Romans, the Ottomans, the British. For one brief moment, there was Jewish autonomy under the Maccabeans, but that was quickly put down. And by the time Jesus utters these words, Jerusalem has been under Gentile occupation for six centuries. Just think about that. Three times as long as America has been a nation, Jerusalem has been under occupation, under Gentile occupation, by one empire after another. And then another 1900 years go by, and suddenly, May 1948, Israel becomes a state, and half of Jerusalem is Jewish for the first time in 2,600 years. June 6, 1967, the rest of the city is captured, the day I was ordained deacon, by the way. And all of Jerusalem is Jewish. August 1980, the Knesset declares that the undivided city of Jerusalem will be the capital of Israel forever. Do you get the sense that we're coming to the end of something? Maybe those two mountains appear to be side by side because who could have possibly expected that the time between the fall of Jerusalem, which was 70 AD, and the reestablishment of Jerusalem could possibly be so far apart? But keep your eye on Jerusalem. When Matthew tells this story, he he immediately follows it with a series of parables, and we tend to use them, tend to get into them during Advent because they all make the same point. You cannot possibly know when, exactly when. You cannot possibly know the day or the hour. Therefore, be ready always. You know, if the servants knew when the master was returning, they'd have been ready. They wouldn't have fallen asleep on their job. If the householder knew when the thief was coming, he'd have been ready. He'd had his guard dogs and his M1 and the police just around the corner. Because he can't know when the thief is coming, be ready always. If the bridesmaids knew when the bridegroom was coming, they'd have been ready. You cannot know when, so be ready always. Luke 21, verse 32. Truly I tell you, this generation will not pass away until all things have taken place. Which generation? The ones that heard him, or the ones that see the signs? It's going to be a time of anxiety, says Jesus. Look at verse 26. People will faint from fear and foreboding of what is coming upon the world, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Now when these things begin to take place, stand up and raise your heads, because your redemption is drawing near. So we lurch our way further and further into this period. Secular men and women are going to be fainting with fear and anxiety. I think back to the time of the Great Depression, where we had bankers leaping off the top of buildings. They were so anxious over just money. But this is going to be much more pervasive. Jesus says people are going to be fainting with fear and foreboding. But as it gets worse and worse, you take more and more encouragement from it, because it simply signs that my coming is that much closer. Well, let's just put this into perspective very quickly. Just remember the timing of this discourse. Jesus' denouement is nearly at hand. It is almost the moment of betrayal, and with that, desertion, false accusation, beating, sentencing, crucifixion, death, descent into hell, resurrection, ascension, and what turns out to be a very, very long period after that. And yet, on the eve of all that beginning, Jesus is looking toward the end and saying, this does have a conclusion. Watch the signs and lift up your hearts as things begin to get really awful, because your redemption draws near. Well, he finishes his discourse. It says, verse 37, every day he was teaching in the temple, and at night he would go out and spend the night on the Mount of Olives, as it was called, and all the people would get up early in the morning to listen to him in the temple. Came the day of the Passover. Passover meal is celebrating God's deliverance of the Israelites from Egyptian slavery and bondage. And every element in that meal is symbolic. They had bitter herbs to remind them of the bitterness of that time of captivity. They had salt water. They would dip some vegetable in salt water, and the salt water was to commemorate the tears that were shed. They made a paste, usually apples and honey, representing the mortar that they were to make, the bricks that they were to make. You remember Pharaoh ordered them to make bricks, and then he wouldn't even supply the straw. All of the elements were symbolic, especially the lamb, whose blood was to be a sign on the doorposts of their trust in God. When the angel of death sees the blood, he will pass over. All of the elements symbolic, but most especially, even more than the lamb, the bread. That meal was called the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Not the Feast of the Lamb, the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Unleavened because leaven, yeast, is usually, not always, but usually a symbol of corruption. And so even today, when the Jews celebrate the Passover, they will symbolically go through the house and find some leaven so they can remove it. It's been put there the day before by the mother. That's just a symbolic commemoration. But this bread is to have no yeast in it. It's to be eaten in haste. We're not going to take the time for it to rise. But also, it's a bread without corruption in it. Jesus fulfills what the Passover meal commemorates. He identifies himself with the God of deliverance. And at the high point of the meal, he takes the bread. Now, bear in mind all of the symbolism that it already has. This is the meal of our deliverance. This is God sparing us from slavery. And he says, "This bread is my body." You will never again eat a Passover meal. You will never again think of God's deliverance without finding me in the middle of the story. He fills an ancient celebration with a new dimension. When he says, "This cup is my blood," it's the fourth cup of the meal, which was to symbolize our joy. Isn't that fascinating? His blood, his sorrow, his death is for our joy. And he moves almost without a pause from instituting the covenant by announcing his betrayal is at hand, to announcing his betrayer is at hand. And the disciples move from horror at the thought, "Could it be me? Who is it?" They move from that to their favorite after dinner topic, "Which of us is the greatest?" Is this amazing? Look at verse 20. He did the same with the cup after supper, saying, "This cup," cup of celebration, cup of joy, "this cup that is poured out for you is the new covenant in my blood." What in the world is he talking about? They have to be staggering at his words. "But see, the one who betrays me is with me. His hand is on the table." You can just see 24 hands being withdrawn from the table right then, don't you? "For the Son of Man is going as it has been determined, but woe to that one by whom he is betrayed." Then they began to ask one another which of them it could be who would do this. And a dispute arose among them as to which of them was the greatest. Amazing. They don't even notice that in the very entertaining of that discussion, they're all betraying him. One more time, Jesus says, "You want to be great? Be a great servant." One more time. In the midst of talking about my death, it's just around the corner. This is the moment that the prophets have waited for. This is what Jeremiah promised. "Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel. Not like the old covenant which I made with your fathers, which you broke." Jesus says, "A new covenant in my blood. I'm going to die. That's what's going to bring in the covenant. One of you is going to betray me." "Which one?" "Not me." "Well, obviously not me. I would never do that. Me betray him? All of you guys would betray him, but never. In fact, I'm the greatest." You get the movement there? And in the midst of all that, one more time, "You want to be great? Be a great servant. Whoever humbles himself will be exalted. I came to serve, you serve too." Verse 31, "Simon, Simon, listen. Satan has demanded to sift all of you like wheat, but I have prayed for you that your own faith may not fail, and you, when once you have turned back, strengthen your brothers." He said to him, "Lord, I'm willing to go with you to prison and to death." Jesus said, "I tell you, the cock isn't going to crow this day until you've denied three times that you even know me." Interesting that he calls him Simon. His old name, Shifty, Sandy. He's not quite Peter yet. "Satan has demanded to have you, just like he did Job And God led him to a point, when adversity comes, know that it's Satan who demands it and God allows it, but for exactly opposite purposes, Satan to destroy you and God to stretch you and bring you to a new conversion and build you up again. And I have prayed for you. Before the next night is over, Peter has horrified himself by fulfilling this prophecy. He goes out and weeps bitterly. And I wonder at what point he remembered that Jesus predicted this. I thought I was going to make it. Jesus saw what I'm really like, and he didn't condemn me. He prayed for me that I might turn again. That can be translated convert again, that I might be converted again. When you are converted again is the way the older translation puts it. And you'll be able to strengthen your brothers. Maybe that was the kindest thing that Jesus ever said to Peter. That I know what you're made of. You think you're going to be so strong, everybody else is going to fall away. You're going to be there to the death. Of course, remember when the soldiers came to arrest Jesus, Peter put his life on the line. You know, that was not an empty claim. It was he who jumped to the front and withdrew his sword and took a hack at the first guy he could come to. But when Jesus says, put away your sword, there's not going to be a fight, he collapses. And moments later, before somebody no more frightening than a servant girl, he is in fact denying that he knows Jesus at all. And he doesn't, does he? He thought he knew him. But at some point, he remembers. Jesus knew all about it beforehand, and prayed for me. He knew all about you and me, too. Judas betrayed him with a kiss. Peter betrayed him with a denial. The disciples betrayed him by falling asleep. And he is utterly deserted. The soldiers mock. The assembly condemns, the disciples scatter, and Jesus is led before Pilate. See you next week.